Today's October 4th, Tuesday morning at Akiva. We usually learn Parshat HaShavua. The truth is this week there's no Parsha. Yom Kippur, there's no Parshat HaShavua. There's a Torah reading. But I decided to do something else that's directly relevant, personally and existentially, to Yom Kippur. What we're going to do is difficult to do an hour. It really should take 2 hours. So on the one hand, we have to limit discussion. On the other hand, the concepts are so searing and so personal that there'll have to be some discussion or else it just won't sink in. So we'll have to see how to navigate this and try and finish by 9 o'clock. The subject is forgiveness. And I want to begin by telling two very short stories that are relevant exactly to this season. One is the following. You might have heard me talk about this in the past, that in 2006 approximately, when I was first in Dallas, my second year, I think, I was teaching something, not this particular class, but something similar right before Yom Kippur, and I was going deep into the concept of forgiveness, and a man about my age who had just come back from South Africa to visit his mother said the following. He said he was there in South Africa sitting on the chair facing his mother and aunt, her sister, who were on the couch, and they were both over 80, talking about old times and reminiscing, and about mother and father and how things used to be. And at one point, one of the sisters blurted out to the other sister, "Mummy always loved you more than me," with great pain and great resentment and almost in tears. And he told me that story in connection to things we've been learning, that look, sometimes 50 years, 60 years go by, even more, and the resentment of one moment or a few moments or of a day or of a month or a year still remains in our hearts, and we're struggling with it, and it weighs us down terribly, sometimes even worse than weighs us down. It gnaws at us and eats up us up inside, and we can't forgive, can't forget, can't forgive. On the other side of the coin, in 2006, just 2 days ago, October 2nd, 2006, it was all the newspapers, a gunman burst into a one-room schoolhouse in Pennsylvania, Dutch country, and he took 10 girls and he shot them in the head execution style, killing 5 of them before he committed suicide shooting himself. And of course it's a terrible tragedy and the pain is unbelievable, but what took up a lot of the headlines in newspapers were the reactions of the Amish themselves, the families of the murdered girls and the rest of the community. And their reaction, at least the way the newspapers covered it, was forgiveness. We've forgiven. They reached out to the family of the murderer, comforted the family, went over and visited, and even 30 of them attended the funeral, saying, "We forgive him. Our feelings shouldn't hold him back from entering heaven." And that's it. That's it. We forgive. No vengeance, no grudges. We wipe the slate clean. And of course, everyone asked themselves, beautiful. Is it beautiful? Is that the way? Just to let a murderer off the hook of your heart in that fashion? So here's two opposite poles. Two women who can't forget, and on the other hand, families that right after the crime seemingly can or are trying to believe the ideal is to just forgive and forget. And it brings us to the whole question, and I don't know how many of you have thought about this, but the more you think about it, the harder it is. What is forgiveness? What does it mean to forgive? How does it work? Where does it happen? Is it between myself and myself, as we say in Hebrew, bein adam la'atzmo? Is it an internal action? Or is it something directly related to the other? Does it have to be spoken? How does it work in our hearts? Are some people born with the genes to forget? And for others, it forgive and forget. Others, it's impossible. What does it mean to forgive? And when I first started looking into this a few years ago, I realized there are whole institutes out there and schools and university courses and books that analyze what it means to forgive. It's very difficult. And after we know, or think we know, very graphic, what actually it is, then the question arises, well, when is it proper? And when is it not proper? So obviously, in an hour, we don't, and we will not find all the answers. And I'm certain that I don't know all the answers, even part of them. But I do believe in the sources we're about to see, there is a key, one little key, that will be so helpful in dealing with these questions, and not only on a theoretical level, but on a very, very personal level. So, what we're going to do is look primarily at sources from Maimonides, from the Rambam. The Rambam is in Egypt, ended his life, died in 1204. He's in Fostat, Old Cairo. And he, of course, is the greatest Jewish thinker that ever lived. The Yemenites say from Moses to Moses, from the first Moses to Moses Maimonides, there was none like Moses, the greatest legalist, philosopher, thinker, doctor. We're going to look at his legal writings, at halakha. But from within the depths of the halakha, we'll be able to discover deep, I think, psychological insights that can be a key to grappling with some of these issues. Ready? The sources are from the Mishneh Torah. The Mishneh Torah is the Rambam's magnum opus of halakha. It's divided into 14 different books, each dealing with a different area of halakha, and each book is divided into sections. So we begin with the first source, which is from the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, Laws of Torts and Damages. Again, everyone has a different pagination, but it's the same sources. Laws of Torts and Damages. Hilchot Chovel u'Mazik. One who has inflicted bodily injury upon his fellow, even if he has paid him the five payments required by halakha, and those five payments, it's always hard for me to say them in English, I just have them in my mind in Hebrew, the five payments are the damages, and loss of wages, and doctor bills, and payment for embarrassment, and payment for
a lag time. Shvut.
Did I say no. Loss of employment?
No.
I didn't, okay. So it's damage, loss of employment, and doctor bills, and embarrassment, and pain. The halakha gives a monetary value, or tries to all those different things.
So which is exactly what American law does.
I'm sure that the world over, it's very, very similar.
Except it's
one who has inflicted bodily injury upon his fellow, even if he has paid him the five payments required by halakha as decided by the court, will not have his sin atoned for, the word in Hebrew is kapara, like Yom Kippur, will not have his sin atoned for and will not be forgiven, he won't have slicha, even if he sacrificed all the sacrifices in the world until he requests forgiveness from the injured party and the latter forgives him.
What is nevayot?
So, all the sacrifices in the world. Type of animal. Don't ask me which one. But it's an expression from the Nevi'im. So, the court rules that I indeed am guilty, let's say, and I owe Mr. X so-and-so damage money, and I have to pay the damage money, as the court decided. But in order to achieve atonement, which is a metaphysical category, in order for God, as it were, to forgive me, the halakha says, I have to request forgiveness, and I have to be granted forgiveness. By who? Not by the court, not by the court, but by the person that I harmed. It is forbidden for the injured party to act cruelly and to refrain from forgiveness. Such is not the way of the seed of Israel. So when we read it, can't act cruelly, you can't refrain from forgiving, that means I have to forgive. So you probably think that means that the guy who harmed me, who hurt me, who damaged me, I have to immediately forgive him. But that's not what the Rambam goes on to say. He says, rather, when one who has inflicted bodily injury requests and begs for forgiveness once and then again, and thereby the injured party knows that he has repented for his sins and regrets his evil, he must forgive him. It's very nuanced. You can't be cruel, you have to forgive. But when do you forgive? Not before you're asked for forgiveness. You wait, even if you want to forgive. Don't forgive until he comes and asks. And not just comes and asks, but he begs. And not just once, but twice. And not only that, You, the injured party, cannot forgive, even if he begged for forgiveness once and twice. You can't forgive unless you're as certain as possible that the request for forgiveness is sincere and is a reflection of regret and of repentance. That means, in a certain sense,
and of decision not to do it again,
which is part of repentance. A great burden is placed by the halakha upon the injured party. The injured party becomes, as it were, it seems, an arbiter of the repentance and of the worthiness to begin his life again, as it were, of the sinner. It is nothing here that says, forgive when you're ready, forgive when you've cleansed your heart, forgive only when you've released the animosity. No, it has nothing to do with what's in the heart of the person who was harmed. It's all about what's in the heart of the person who did the harm. And I, the person who was harmed, somehow have to do my best to figure out, to ascertain what the person who harmed me is feeling and where he is in his repentance. And I should not be cruel and not refrain from forgiving, but that doesn't mean forgive immediately. It means wait to forgive, and it might mean wait a long time, until, as honestly as possible, you think that that person's request for forgiveness is really reflective of a deep inner process that he's gone through and completed.
So the Amish way is not this way.
We don't want to jump to conclusions too quickly, but that's what it looks like.
But when, if the person who perpetrated the sin, or the evil deed or bad deed, is no longer here, he cannot seek forgiveness. In the case of this man who killed himself.
That's
true.
And this is also that he must forgive him. It's not, it's a requirement.
It's a requirement under certain circumstances.
It's not forbidden. It's not prohibited to forgive earlier. It's not prohibited to forgive without these things. It's just once these things are met, you then have to forgive. So I don't think it precludes just yet the Amish way.
Okay.
Legal, kind of a legal analysis.
And I'm not going to say anything because we're going to see more. One who is quick to forgive is praiseworthy. Quick to forgive in this context means quick to forgive in the framework of what the Rambam set down. And that becomes clearer in the next source we're going to see. It doesn't mean quicker than is listed here. It means as quick as is listed here. One who is quick to forgive is praiseworthy and is acting according to the spirit of the sages.
But the Amish thing is inconsistent because the person who did the killing also died, so he cannot ask forgiveness.
Right.
And actually we'll see that in such a case, the category of forgiveness is inoperable. Because forgiveness is an action, and I'm already giving more away, it's a relationship with a living person. You can't forgive a dead person. There are other things you can do, but it's not called forgiveness.
It's the same for the, if the victim is not alive anymore, that victim cannot
forgive.
So the person who killed the person, other person, can never receive forgiveness, maybe from the family, but not from that person.
He can go to the grave.
We're going to get to that in the next source.
Well, I know, like we were, years ago, we were in Birkenau, and when we were walking around, we may have told you this story, and these German Christians came up to us, and they went down on their knees, and they asked for forgiveness. And our guide, who was Israeli, said, no, we cannot forgive you, of course, because that's for the... But anyway, it was interesting to have that happen to us.
Right. Certainly, among Holocaust survivors, in the whole matter of the Holocaust, the question of what is forgiveness has to arise before we say we can or cannot forgive.
And I noticed that with Germans that I've encountered, that they have a huge need to be forgiven, although they were not that generation.
Yeah, some of them, yeah. Another source. The next source is the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, the Laws of Repentance, Hilchot Teshuvah.
Oh,
some of you might have an old edition that might say chapter 9, it's chapter 2. If you have an old edition there, you can fix it. Laws of Repentance, mm-hmm. Chapter 2, Laws 9 and 10. Repentance and the Day of Atonement. Shuvah and Yom HaKippurim. Atone only for sins, such as eating a forbidden food, having prohibited intercourse, etc., which are committed against God. In other words, there's no injured party, there's no human party that's hurt. Sins such as injuring another person, cursing him, stealing, etc., which are committed against one's fellow man, in addition to being sins against God as well, are never forgiven until he has paid any necessary payments to the person against whom he has sinned, as we've talked, the five payments, if the court decided such, and has made peace with the injured party, that is the forgiveness that we've talked about. So that just shows you that everything we're talking about the fact that you have to ask forgiveness, that's only if it's a sin against man. It's a sin against God. There's no forgiveness necessary. There's confession, but not forgiveness. You don't ask God to forgive you. You don't ask a rabbi to forgive you. You don't ask anyone to forgive you. There's nothing to forgive. Because forgiveness is always a relationship between two human beings. That's the very nature of the matter. Even though he may have paid back any due, he still has to make peace with him and request that he will forgive him. Even if he merely sinned against the other verbally, he still must appease him and entreat of him until the other party forgives him. So there are sins that aren't physical damage. It could be slander. That's also damage, though not physical. If the person against whom he sinned did not want to forgive him, I came once and I came twice and he won't forgive me, and I'm as sincere as I can be, then he must bring three of his fellows to entreat of him and request of him that he forgive. You bring with you an entourage. If he still didn't want to forgive him, then he must bring him the three a second and third time. And if he still didn't want to forgive him, he may leave him and go his way. In such a case, the one that refuses to forgive is the sinner. That's called cruelty. That's called cruelty. If the injured party was his teacher, he must ask for forgiveness even 1,000 times until he receives forgiveness. This is basically a recap of what we've seen already with a little bit of extra background.
But all that implies that compensation was made.
Absolutely. We said that. The money that is due was paid.
But even defaming, you have to undo some of the damage.
The court might decide that I have to pay for whatever payments it is, for the embarrassment, for the pain,
right?
Perhaps even for the loss of work caused by the slander.
So if you try hard enough at a certain point...
You've done enough.
Yeah.
You've done enough. It is forbidden...
Pardon?
Six times. Is that you have to go three times, and then you have to go with your three friends three times?
That's what it looks like.
Why do you have to bring the three friends?
I think to add gravity, to show that I'm really serious. It's not just I'm saying that I repented and I regret it, but these two people also testify that my repentance is sincere. Again, it's a matter of convincing the injured party that I really am sincere and contrite and I've turned over a new leaf.
And something about, I'm sorry, something about evil speech, when it's said in the presence of three people, you can repeat it.
Oh, but that's not at all.
But if you have three people with you, whatever you say to the other person about admitting guilt and repentance, that is, it's not secret anymore. It's public. And that may... I don't know if that concept has something to do with it.
It's a confession.
I don't know.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I never thought of that.
Can I ask one question? It seems your focus is going to be on sins between people. But on when we're asking forgiveness from God, does God hold the same standards?
So again, we're not asking forgiveness from God.
No, on Yom Kippur. The sins that we... The ritual sins or whatever, the sins between us and God. So does God hold the same standards?
I'm not God's spokesman.
No, I know that, but what does the religion say? Anything about that?
It does not say that God holds the same standards at all. Again, according to the Rambam,
the three steps of tshuva.
It's something else. It's not forgiveness in this sense. Forgiveness is between man and man. You don't have to ask forgiveness of God. What you have to do with God is to do all of the steps of tshuva, and you have to, one of which is confession. And if we talk about forgiveness vis-a-vis God, and we do, we're talking about something else. There we're talking about mercy beyond the letter of the law. Here we're talking about the framework of the law. And I certainly admit that we use the word forgiveness, in Hebrew michila and shlicha, far beyond the confines in the way the Rambam is rigidly defining it. But it's going to be very helpful to really limit this definition and call other things that we sometimes call forgiveness to call them by a different name, as we're about to see.
And tshuva both ways too.
Tshuva applies both between sins for man and man and man and God. Look at the last paragraph in the Rambam, which parallels the last paragraph in the previous Rambam we saw. It is forbidden to be harsh and non-appeasing. One should rather be easily appeased than slow to anger, which means to give forgiveness wholeheartedly. Wholesale, no, not wholesale. And whenever a sinner asks one for forgiveness, but only then, one should grant it wholeheartedly and willingly. But only then, not when you're not asked. Even if the sinner has distressed one considerably and sinned against one a lot, one must not take revenge or bear a grudge. We'll get back to that. Such is the way of the seed of Israel whose hearts are proper, that we don't bear a grudge and we're easily appeased and we immediately forgive. Immediately means when it's deserved and not before. And after all that, we're now going to see something that seems to throw a wrench into the whole soup. What a mixed metaphor.
That's when you write
that little tag phrase, and not before, is not explicit yet.
Well, it says, first he said, easily appeased and slow to anger, and whenever a sinner asks for forgiveness, one should grant it.
But it doesn't say you can't grant it beforehand.
I think that's the tenor of the whole thing.
Right, okay. So
in
that's
the first one, it did, I think.
He must forgive him once he has requested it, and you believe he's sincere. But it doesn't. Nowhere does it explicitly say you should not forgive him before these things happen.
Okay, I think that's the tenor of the whole thing.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, it's an implied.
But you're right. You're right. There's nothing beyond what we just read.
But you add a caveat, and you believe he's sincere, which is the question that is defined is how do you know he's sincere?
And the only way to judge is through his words and his actions.
So whether you judge him not to be sincere,
then I think that you're not allowed to forgive.
Well, and who are you to judge?
No. Here, you are put up as a judge.
I understand that, but
you have to be the one to be the judge.
You're supposed to judge.
I understand that.
If you're not ready to forgive, it's pretty easy to judge that the forgiveness is not sincere.
Okay. Very good. That leads us to the next source.
What did you say?
It was very deep and very... I can't repeat it.
If
you're not ready to forgive, it's very easy then to look upon the person who's begging forgiveness as being not sincere.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's holding a grudge.
Exactly. Exactly. Which brings us to the next source.
No, you're not holding a grudge. No,
wait with that. Let's see what it says. I'm sorry that I'm doing this to you, but I don't want to find myself in the middle at 9 o'clock. This is the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, Laws of Character Traits. The Laws of Character Traits. Hilchot De'ot, Chapter 7, Laws 7 and 8. One who takes revenge on someone else is transgressing a negative commandment, for it is written, you shall not take revenge, from the beginning of Parshat Kedoshim in the book of Vayikra, Leviticus. Even though committing this sin does not make one liable to flogging, and for some sins the court does flog you, for this one not, it is nevertheless a very bad characteristic. It is fitting to wipe away his hurt, and that is a technical phrase. The Hebrew is ma'avir al midotav, wipe away his hurt. We're going to really underline that. It is fitting to wipe away his hurt concerning all things of this world. For in truth, the enlightened understand that all personal affronts are meaningless and are simply not worth taking revenge over. So here's the Rambam, the philosopher, putting in words of wisdom within the framework of the halakha. What is revenge? If, for example, his fellow came and said, "Please lend me your axe, or your ox, or your car, or a cup of sugar," and he responded, "He will not lend it out." And then later, the second one went to the first and asked to borrow his axe, or his car, or his ox, or a cup of sugar. And he responded by saying, "Just as you did not lend me your axe, or your ox, or your sugar, so I will not lend you my axe, or my ox, or my sugar." Then he is taking revenge. So revenge is not necessarily only what you have thought. Revenge is when you refrain from doing something because the other person refrained from doing it for you. It's tit for tat. Rather, when one comes to request, he should lend wholeheartedly and not recompense the other in the way that he himself was treated. Similar situations have the same law.
It's That's almost revenge. Like give the other cheek.
That's what it looks like. Let's go on. Similarly, anyone who bears a grudge against another Jew is also transgressing a negative commandment. For it is written, "Nor bear a grudge against the children of your people." The same verse as the one that mentions revenge. It's one verse in the beginning of Parshat Vayikra. Kedoshim, in the book of Vayikra. What is a grudge? If, for example, Reuben asked Shimon to rent him his house or lend him his ox, or his ass, again, or his axe, or a cup of sugar, and Shimon refused. And then after some time, Shimon asked him for a loan or rental from Reuven of sugar, or of a house, or of an ox, or of a car. And Reuven gives it to him, but tells him, "I'll lend it to you, I'm not like you, and neither am I going to play tit for tat." Then Reuven is transgressing the injunction against bearing a grudge. So,
it's one step farther.
Right, so I give him what he wants, but I say, you know,
I'm not like you.
I'm not like you. I'll give it to you. Now, I'll just tell you parenthetically that in the commentators on the Rambam, there's a little bit of a disagreement here. Where exactly is the focus of the sin? Is it in the words you speak or in the thoughts you think? Because what happens if I don't say to him, "I'm not like you, but I think it"? Am I transgressing, not bearing a grudge? Not clear.
Aren't we more a religion of action versus thought?
The next sentence says, you should really erase it from your heart.
Right, so you should erase it from your heart. But what happens if you didn't erase it from your heart?
Well, then,
but you didn't speak it.
But you still did the right thing.
That's a half a point.
Right, it's a grace. And the commentators talk about how we parse that situation in which you didn't speak it, but you thought it.
You can control more your actions, but it's very hard to control your thoughts.
It's hard, but it's sometimes a desideratum. Sometimes we're asked to do that. We're commanded to do that. And indeed, in this matter, there's a whole discussion in the later authorities. Can the Torah command us to control our thoughts? And aren't there some cases in which we try, but we just can't?
We're commanded to.
There are those who say that love of your neighbor is really a commandment of behaving towards him lovingly, but not necessarily what you feel. Others say there is feelings.
You're commanded to love your God?
And perhaps loving your God means acting lovingly, but just not necessarily feeling something. Again, it's a big, big discussion.
The only commandment that I know, and I'm not that well studied, but the do not covet your neighbor, that of your neighbor.
That's a good example right there. It's explicit, but there's a big discussion there. Yeah, wow.
Right, there's huge discussions, but, well, it's not just you actually have to take an action. It's not just the thought in your mind, that commandment, I thought, that I'd read someplace.
Okay. Well, here it says, there's a big discussion there.
I don't know. He says, don't remember. Remember to forget.
Reuven must rather erase the matter of having been refused from his heart and must not bear a grudge, but rather must totally erase the matter from his heart and not remember it at all. This is the proper temperament. So now, the way to begin understanding everything is to realize that we ostensibly understand nothing.
Right.
Because there seems to be a glaring contradiction between the first two sources and the third source. So we have to understand the contradiction and be bothered by it, and then we can look for a resolution. So what's the contradiction, Ilana?
In the first two sources and the third? Bearing of grudge or not bearing of grudge, and total action.
Okay, right, so we can say that, we can develop it a little bit. In the first two sources,
well,
it basically says, don't forgive
until all these conditions are fulfilled.
Right, and here it says,
don't harden your heart.
Don't harden your heart, forgive immediately, just let it go, forget about it, forgive, forget, finished.
It's kind of Amishy.
You could say that. You could say that explicitly. Do you hear what you're saying?
Can you?
Yeah.
It sort of defines not forgiving as bearing a grudge. And I guess that might be accurate. I just don't know that it... I just haven't...
Okay, so very good point.
So we're back to the question, what it is it to forgive?
So linguistically now, what central phrase or terminology is missing from this third halakha in the laws of character traits?
Forgiving.
There's no mention of forgiveness. And that's going to be the key to the whole thing. We'll be able to discover that there's no contradiction at all, because the third source is not talking about forgiveness, it's talking about something else.
The difference is if it's in you or your attitude to the your feelings or
correct.
The other person.
Correct. There's two different areas of discussion here. One is something that's called Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, between man and man. And the other is Bein Adam L'Atzmo, between man and himself. Two different discussions. We'll still have to see what allows us to separate the two. And we'll have to see where the confluence and connection is. But at least theoretically, there's two different discussions here. And that's going to be a key to understanding what forgiveness really is and what it isn't.
Well, in the third one, there's no... I mean, he asked to borrow something and he didn't give it to him. That's not a sin.
Exactly! That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. It's a nice thing to lend your possessions, but there's no commandment to do so. And if you didn't do so, you're not guilty. You don't have to ask for forgiveness because you didn't do anything legally wrong. Now, of course, it might be nice to ask for forgiveness, just like it's nice to begin with, to lend your possessions.
If you're drowning and you ask for a life ring, then you do have to give it.
That's pikuach nefesh.
Okay, there's going to be lots of radical cases, polar.
But at the same time, he's saying when that person in turn asks to borrow something from you, you're required to give it.
Not exactly.
No, you're taught to remember what he did to you.
In other words, you don't have to give it, but if you're going to not give it, you have to not give it for the right reason, not for the wrong reason.
Not on the grounds of bearing.
Not as an act of aggression.
Right. In other words, if I only have one cup of sugar in my home, and I need it tonight for a dinner party, and someone comes an hour before, my neighbor, and asks to lend a cup, to borrow a cup of sugar, I don't have to give it to them. And I have good reason not to. And even if I have 10 bags of sugar, I don't have to lend out my possessions. Again, it's not a nice thing to hoard them and refrain from doing so, but there's no legal obligation to do so. It also might be that last year I lent him a cup of sugar and he kept forgetting to return it, and I reminded him he never returned. I realized it's not worth lending things, so I don't get them back. Or I gave him my axe and he nicked it or it died. There's lots of good reasons not to lend things out.
I have a hard time lending books because they always come, they never come back, and if they come back, they're torn.
Yeah.
It's kind of
good example. So it might be good for Ilana to go beyond the letter of the law and lend out her books and keep a list of who took them and hire someone to go get them back to them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
No neck, Tony.
But she doesn't have to do that. So this matter of bearing a grudge or not bearing a grudge, and revenge or not taking revenge, we're talking, at least in this isolated example, we're talking about cases in which no crime was committed, no repentance is necessary, no forgiveness asking is called for, and we're just focusing on me, the person who's the sent here, and I'm not supposed to bear a grudge. If I'm going not to lend, it can't be because I'm following tit for tat. There might be other good reasons not to lend.
you're talking about individual, not society.
In the meanwhile, we're talking about individuals.
Right now.
Let's see a few more things, and we'll open it up to see how to apply this in a wider fashion.
No, because you see all the time, quite often, where somebody has murdered or killed somebody else, and the person whose friend or wife or husband forgives the killer, but at the same point in time, society goes ahead and punishes that killer.
Very good. Let's talk about that right now. Because what that actually is looking at the three different sources we've seen now as one tapestry. Let's see how we can put them together. I'm going to say as follows. If we're looking at the third source, we don't have to think about the first two. But if we're looking at the first two, we also have to think about the third. In other words, if we have a situation, a scenario like the third source, in which no crime was committed, nothing that demands repentance, at least not on a legal level, happened, so the only issue is bearing a grudge, not bearing a grudge, revenge, not taking revenge, and there's no question of forgiveness, of granting forgiveness. There's no interpersonal matter. It's all between me and myself. However, if I go to the first two sources, which a crime was committed on some level, there's forgiveness involved, but there also is the personal matter of grudge, not grudge, revenge, and not revenge. So here we have to say the following. In this case, this complicated case in which a crime was committed, there are two issues now to deal with. To deal with the issue of forgiveness or not forgiveness, and to deal with the issue of grudge and revenge or not grudge and revenge. And they are unrelated. Completely unrelated. And it gets back to something that Bob said earlier. What I mean by unrelated, I mean that when a person who wronged me comes and asks for forgiveness, my granting or not granting forgiveness has to be unrelated to my personal issue of grudge or not grudge.
Oh,
and on the other hand, my personal issue of bearing grudge or not has to be unrelated to his asking for forgiveness or not. They have nothing to do one for the other. And as soon as we internalize that and talk about it, you'll realize, I think, that it's a key to psychological health.
Oh, so because the grudge damages you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the forgiveness is for the sake of the other person.
Right, and they're unrelated.
But a sincere forgiveness seems like would have to release the grudge.
No, not if we understand what forgiveness is. According to these sources.
Forgiveness is releasing the other person.
Right. What is forgiveness? Forgiveness, according to
the
Rambam,
the other.
Is the following. Right. That I have been set up by God, by the halakha, as an arbiter of this criminal's spiritual and moral rehabilitation. And it's my job to help him in his rehabilitation. If I grant him forgiveness too soon, I have cut off his process of personal rehabilitation. I have not allowed him to continue the deep soul-searching that's necessary by forgiving him too soon. On the other hand, if I wait too long to forgive him, I'm being cruel. I'm an arbiter. I have to be, as far as possible, an objective arbiter of his process. And I'm not saying that's easy. It's impossible completely, but that's the ideal. And to be an objective arbiter, to be a judge, I have to, as much as possible, leave myself out of it. It might be that I'm seething inside and I can't release the grudge, but when I see he's repented, I have to say, check.
Two-step process.
But I'm still seething inside. I'm seething inside. That's my problem. It's not his problem. On the other hand, I might be one of the Amish people. I've completely released it from my heart. But how dare I tell him that I forgive him until he asks for it properly. It's unrelated. this is a key to psychological health. Because just think how this releases us from so many different issues in life. For my sense of release, of freedom from the past, from those juices stewing inside me, I don't have to wait for him or her. It's about me. It's about how I want to live my life. And on the other hand, he or her doesn't have to wait for me to be released from the past. It's rather when they ask for forgiveness properly, then it has to be granted.
The Amish perhaps should have used the term grudge. Look, we don't bear a grudge. That's it. You know, we're not holding it inside of us. We don't want revenge. We're not bearing a grudge. Rather than using the word forgiveness.
On the other hand.
Yes, some of it is terminology.
Yes.
But in our terminology.
But
maybe they...
You're right. But to be consistent...
Christian thinking is very different.
But applying our thinking there, it would certainly... It's a good thing not to bear a grudge, as we've seen. But it's not something you have to vocalize vis-a-vis the other. Because that's already blurring the boundaries between forgiveness and not bearing a grudge.
So the forgiveness is more of a technical...
It's a technical matter.
Technical? For such a basic thing, how can you say it's only a technical?
Well, I'm really here manipulating.
It's the grudge. It's the psychological inner work that's the more emotional.
Long as you cannot have revenge, so long as you have a society that's going to do justice, which other words mean punishes somebody for the crime.
That's a very good point, because what we're saying here is that refraining from bearing a grudge has nothing to do with carrying out or not carrying out justice. In other words, you can certainly have a situation, and you actually should have a situation, in which a party has been wronged deeply, and that party has not forgiven, but has released the grudge, but that same party is willing to pursue justice and to go up on the witness stand and give testimony that's going to bring this person to justice.
Good.
Absolutely.
Assuming you have a society that will give justice.
That's what the legal system implies.
That's the first thing, even the nullified law. I mean, you know, everyone has to have a court.
That's why we are a society with law.
Whether it carries out what you think is justice or not, you have a court.
So if we want to look at a very, very difficult, radical case, like Holocaust survivors,
right.
I don't really have permission to put myself in their place, but let's use that as a model. So there are very good reasons, halachic and psychological, to search for inner cleansing in the sense of releasing grudges.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean to forgive. Doesn't mean to forget.
That's correct.
I do remember.
That's very interesting.
Doesn't mean not to pursue justice.
And I still remember, though, a couple years ago in Tel Aviv, we were with a friend of ours, and he introduced us to a German citizen who had basically moved to Tel Aviv, and he spent the rest of his life on doing what he could for survivors, and that was... Mm-hmm. That was what he was doing for asking forgiveness.
That's a form of atonement.
Yes.
Which is essential.
Yeah.
So we have a few minutes, thank God, to go on to connect this to Yom Kippur. But I really suggest to give it a lot of thought at home. It has to percolate. Because it's such a radically different way of looking.
On the other hand, if you don't have a society that will seek justice, then you take it upon yourself to... Are you seeking justice or are you seeking revenge?
That's a hard line to draw.
No, it's a very simple thing. If there's no society that... You know, you look upon the fact that after the war, you would have quite a few of the Jewish brigade. And what they would do is they would identify the war criminals and go in there and kill them individually. And you have the specific situation of Abner Kovner, remember, who went there and attempted to poison the entire food supply of a German prisoner of war camp.
Mm-hmm.
And which was...
Did he succeed?
What? Do you remember that?
Okay, this is also just for forgiveness and holding a grudge against your fellow Jew.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
there's no halakha against bearing a grudge against against
Okay, that's a whole can't push a worm.
Okay,
in which we have to examine this definition.
Against God?
No, against God, against the German army.
There are many, many, many mitzvot ben adam lachavero between man and man that the Torah says are directed towards b'nei britecha, members of the covenant, or amitecha, your fellow, or re'echa, your neighbor. And the Mahalacha defines who is your neighbor. And that's an ongoing question in many areas.
Okay.
But I can certainly say that until this very day, there's a machloket there. There are those that say it applies to all human beings. There are those.
Okay. Okay. And with the Maimonides, these two sections, one was with Jews and one was with non-Jews.
Mm-hmm. Where did you see that? Where did you see that?
Well, the first section said to a fellow, I thought. The first one was bodily injury upon his fellow.
Okay, but in the end, it's a different language, but it means the same thing.
I thought that was a.
But I don't want to go into that now. So I want to go on. I want to take 10 more minutes to expand the canvas. Let's look not at the next source, but the source after the next. It's a two-liner. In Hebrew, it's only one line. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Psachim, page 13b.
Where's that?
It's a source after the next. So here we are. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Psachim, page 13b.
Ah.
The Holy One, blessed be He, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, loves three kinds of men. Those that never become angry, those that never become intoxicated, and those that do not hurt, nurse their hurt. Now that phrase, nurse their hurt, is a technical term. That's the other side of the coin. When we talked about wipe away the hurt. Nurse it or wipe it away. Now this source, of course, speaks in hyperbole, but the point, I think, is extremely important, critical. To search for the common denominator that ties together anger, intoxication, and nursing of hurt. And since time is very short, I'll just say it briefly. The key is intoxication. There we understand that we are allowing, of our own free will, a foreign substance, an invader, a demon. We're opening up the gate to this force to come and overcome us. And make us do and say, and perhaps even feel, things that aren't us, that aren't real, that aren't of our own free will.
So,
and the rabbis seem to be saying that anger is the same thing. Anger is a demon that you let in. It's not you. It overtakes you, it overcomes you, it conquers you, and sometimes it's too late. You should have headed them off at the pass and locked the gate. And perhaps, to me this is pretty clear, that nursing of hurt is part and parcel of this category. That there is a decision that some people make, and for some people it's almost impossible not to make that decision, but it's a decision in a certain place in our heart that we make to let in the demon of nursing of hurt, of resentment, of hate, of the desires for grudge and revenge. And then it takes you over, and it's not you, and it destroys your life from within, just like alcoholism. And just like anger, you're taken over from inside. And there has to be a personal decision to do what's best for you. And that is to keep your free will and not let intoxication or anger or the nursing of a grudge to overtake you and ruin your life. And after saying that, we'll look at the next two sources. Babylon and Talmud Tractate Tanit, page 25b, which is about Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer is a very famous figure in the Mishnah. This is Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, the great Rabbi Eliezer. His last name was Horkunus. Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkunus. I want to tell you two things we know about Rabbi Eliezer. The Mishnah says that he was a boar seed, she'eno mabed tipa. He was a plastered cistern that never loses a drop.
It's in Pirkei Avot.
He never loses a drop of water. Ein ma'im ela Torah. Water is Torah. He had a photographic memory. Another point about Rabbi Eliezer.
Didn't he pray?
The Mishnah also says that
Me'olam lo amar davar shelo shama mirabo. He never said anything he didn't hear from his rabbis. He had no need to be innovative, no need to think for himself really, no need to search for solutions because he knew everything that had been said. With that information, look what happened to Rabbi Eliezer. Another time it happened that Rabbi Eliezer prayed in front of the congregation and recited the 24 benedictions of the special prayers for drought, but he was not answered. The Mishnah in Tractate Tanit has very, very complicated and rigid laws how you react to drought. And the worse it gets, the more prayer, the more fasting. There's even a special ceremony with shofarot and trumpets and 24 blessings expanding the Shmona Esrei from 18 to 24 for drought. And of course, the leader of the people, the greatest scholar, stands in front of the congregation and leads the prayers. That was Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Akiva led the congregation in prayer after him, and he said, Avinu Malkeinu, we have no other king but thee. Avinu Malkeinu, for thine own sake, have mercy upon us. Rabbi Akiva added apparently some of his own prayers, and the rains fell. The drought ended through the merit of Rabbi Akiva. The people then began to murmur and say that Rabbi Akiva must be a greater scholar than Rabbi Eliezer. Hear what's going on here? Why did the rain fall for Rabbi Akiva, not Rabbi Eliezer? Rabbi Akiva must be greater. A heavenly voice went forth and said, not because Rabbi Akiva is greater in scholarship than Rabbi Eliezer, was his prayer answered, but because he always wiped away his hurt. While Rabbi Eliezer did not ever wipe away his hurt. Rabbi Akiva was blessed with not having a photographic memory. Rabbi Akiva was able to forget. We're making here the connection between intellectual forgetfulness and emotional forgetfulness. And of course, many of us, I believe, myself, for me it's certainly true, I have often wanted to have a photographic memory. But there is a downside to it. If you can't forget the past, you end up living in the past. And you end up being tied down by the past and bogged down by the past and shackled in the past. And Rabbi Eliezer, I'm sure he wanted to release the grudges he was holding, but he couldn't do it. Because it was like it just happened right now. And it was alive and real and the emotions were still churning. He couldn't release anything.
You know,
and that was his downfall. And there's a story in the Gemara that actually that was his ultimate downfall in the worst possible way.
I'm having a lot of trouble that he is punished for something that God gave him.
No, it's not for his memory, it's for his emotional memory.
No, but it's a character he's born with. You're right. In other words, we're all born with a certain deck of cards. And for some people it's very easy to forget, and for others it's extremely difficult, almost impossible. But I always have to add that word, almost. It's almost impossible. But it's not completely impossible. Apparently he didn't make enough of an effort to try to forget. There's clearly a criticism of him in this passage, even though he's one of the greatest of his generation. So it could be, I have a talent for forgetting. I can forget anything. So it could be, if I forget all my grudges, I just get a 9.5. But if Rabbi Eliezer was to forget even half of a grudge, he'd get a 10.
You know, Agnon is talking about many times about people who are kind of, he said, God was kind to that person. He made him blind so he wouldn't see the evil of the children of Israel. So,
exactly.
On the other hand, there's inconsistency here because basically, to a large degree, as you get to know people more, you know who you trust and who you don't trust. And in fact, remembering the ones that you don't trust because they don't follow through, or you can't believe what they say, or you can't believe the judgment, is that bearing a grudge, or is that just...
It's not bearing a grudge. Grudge is not how I act towards him. It's my own inner psychological... I just want to end, before people go, I want to bring this to Yom Kippur. Yeah. One more source, which is about Yom Kippur. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Rosh Hashanah, page 17a. Rava said, one of the great rabbis of Babylonia, all who wipe away their hurt, their sins are all wiped away. As it says in the book of Micha, He pardoneth iniquity and forgiveth transgression. The simple meaning of the verse is that He, meaning God, pardoneth iniquity, and God also forgives transgression. It's poetic license, the same thing being said twice. But the drasha, the homily, says that the subject of the verbs is different. He pardons iniquity for people who pardon transgression of others. That's the way it's read. For whom does He pardon iniquity? For him who forgiveth transgression committed against his neighbor. Of course, here we're using the word forgiveness. What we really mean is not bearing a grudge. Let's read. Rav Huna ben Rabbi Yeshua fell sick, and Rav Papa went to visit him. The lattice of the end was near, and said to those present, make ready his shrouds. But in the end he recovered, didn't die. And Rav Papa was ashamed to see him, because Rav Papa said he's going to die, and he didn't die. Why did you think him so sick? Said they. He was so indeed, he replied. He really was sick to die. He was on his deathbed. But the Holy One, blessed be He, said that since he never nursed his hurt, hurt will not be nursed against him. In other words, it was a miracle. He died. He almost died. He was going to die. But miraculously, God pardoned him, or God didn't bear a grudge against him for any sin he committed, because he himself, I mean the man on his deathbed, during his life had never nursed any hurt. As it is written, he pardoneth iniquity and forgiveth the transgression. For whom does he pardon iniquity? For him who forgives transgression. So this is trying to say that who are, and I'll use the word forgiveness, but it's not forgiveness since we've been using, who's forgiven by God? Those who forgive others. More technically in our terms, who does God not bear a grudge against? Those people who don't bear a grudge against others. Now, this, I think, can be understood on rational terms. Not as a miracle, not as supernatural divine providence, perhaps it's that also, but it could be understood on simple psychological terms. Because bearing a grudge means living in the past. It means being caught up in what happened yesterday and not being able to live in the present. Not being able to see that the situation has changed and there are new steps of life in front of me. It's always looking backwards. And the claim is, and I think this is a deep psychological claim, that if you live in the past on one level, vis-a-vis one person, one event, you'll tend to live in the past on other levels as well. And if I'm only looking backwards, then I won't be able to do tshuva, to make amends, to turn my life around, to turn over a new leaf on so many other different levels.
You're kind of arrested in many ways.
Whereas, if I'm able to release grudges from the past concerning X, Y, and Z, I will develop, I will nurture in my personality an openness to change. And that openness to the newness, to change, to the present and the future, will allow me to do tshuva, to turn over a new leaf on so many different levels, and I'll be forgiven by God. So what it's actually saying is that your fate's in your own hands. If you want to live in the present, all you have to do is decide not to live in the past. But if you don't take that tremendously important and difficult decision to get out of the past, you'll end up in the past in so many different ways that you never even thought of.
Yeah.
And that perhaps is one key to Yom Kippur.
Beautiful.
So, Shana Tova.
Shana Tova.
And I see you have at the end the little prayer at the bedtime Shema. Can you tie that in real quickly? Do you have...
The prayer, there's a custom of forgiving when you go to sleep.
I'm lost page.
Now, what I would claim is, it's not forgiveness, it's rather release from grudge. If I would be able every night to take 5 minutes, or even three, to go over the events of the day, and release myself from the past, well then I would be catapulted into the present on so many different levels, and my personality expands to embrace the newness of the day and the newness that my personality can
it's the same thing.
Contain. The same thing. Nothing new.
So, I'm not to harp on semantics, but you talk about forgetting. I don't think it's forgetting. You don't necessarily have to forget what happened, but you have to resolve to move on.
True.
Good. My father said, I'm writing. I'll forget and you'll forget and I'll remember. It's kind of two levels.
What did he say?
He says, I'll forget and you'll forget and I'll remember.
Good job.
Yeah.
Right. You don't forget. So, you know,
you
sometimes
don't forget,
you
move
shouldn't
on.
Forget. You shouldn't necessarily forget in order to protect yourself from future.
Well, that's the point. That's the,
right. You have right. to learn something.
You do have
absolutely.
To learn.
But you,
really
into, you release it.
Absolutely.
You right. something.
Absolutely.
You have to release the emotional luggage.
Right. Exactly.
Yep.
The baggage.
But the brain has to function.
Yep. For our own good. For our own good. Right. So next week, there's a class.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the week after, there's a class.
Are we going to meet in the sukkah?
Could you look into that?